Good afternoon. I'm glad to see that the Sun has decided to join us today. My name is Joseph Emerson. I'm a postdoctoral fellow here at the Institute. I received my PhD in theoretical physics from Simon Fraser University in 2001 and spent 2 years as a postdoc at MIT before coming to join the Perimeter Institute a year ago. So far, it's been a wonderful experience. I'm very excited that we're moving into this new building. It's an honor for me to introduce Professor Hartle to you today. Professor Hartle is from Baltimore, Maryland. He received his bachelor's degree from Princeton and his PhD from Caltech. He has taught at Princeton, University of Chicago, and is currently professor of physics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His scientific work is concerned with the application of Einstein's general theory of relativity to realistic astrophysical situations, especially cosmology. He has made important contributions to the understanding of gravitational waves, relativistic stars, and black holes. His current interest is in quantum cosmology, which is the search for a quantum theory of the origin of the universe. This search has led him to work on the foundations of quantum mechanics, where he has helped develop the decoherent histories formalism in an effort to identify a suitable quantum framework for this problem. Professor Hartle is also an author of a textbook, Gravity: An Introduction to Einstein's General Relativity. He has been a Sloan Foundation Fellow, a Guggenheim Fellow, and held various visiting positions at Cambridge University. He is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a founder and past director of the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara. Professor Hartle has also served on our Scientific Advisory Committee and helped develop and guide our young institute. It is a pleasure to have him here this weekend as we celebrate the opening of our new building. Today, Professor Hartle will be lecturing on Einstein's vision and the quantum universe. Please join me with applause in welcoming our distinguished lecturer.
Thank you for that introduction, and most importantly, thank you for not mentioning the dates that went with any of those. It's a special pleasure to be here in the Mike Lazaridis Lecture Theater in the Perimeter Institute. We'll see it off to a good start. I'm going to tell you a little bit about two subjects, which are general relativity and quantum mechanics. If a cat, a cannonball, and an economics textbook are dropped from the height of a tower, under the action of gravity, they all fall to the ground with exactly the same acceleration, 9.8 meters per second squared. That's a fact which is known, the equality of the accelerations, to one part in a few parts in 1,000,000,000,000. This equality of gravitational accelerations is an example of a fundamental law of physics. It's fundamental because we believe it holds without exception, without qualification, and without approximation. Such fundamental laws are what the Perimeter Institute is all about. And it's about some aspects of these laws and the Perimeter Institute's role in the search for them that I want to talk to you today. Now, where a cat and a cannonball and an economics textbook drop from a real leaning tower, the accelerations wouldn't be equal to the accuracy I quoted, because there's not just gravity acting, but lots of other forces, for example, air resistance. The equality of gravitational accelerations is something that can be demonstrated experimentally only in very delicate laboratory experiments or with astronomical bodies that are so big that other forces are sort of negligible in comparison. The current world record holder for accuracy is the observations of the position of the moon by lunar laser ranging. The Apollo astronauts in the 60s and early 70s and the Russian manned and unmanned missions to the moon left behind them arrays of corner reflectors, which you can see a little one over here, and I think you can maybe even see Neil Armstrong's footprint there to give you an idea of the size. A corner reflector is just simply an arrangement of three mirrors that meet in the vertex of a cube. And it has the geometrical property that if a light ray comes in on the corner reflector, it bounces around the mirrors somehow and comes straight back out from the way it came. Well, since 1969, for over 35 years, the McDonald Observatory in Texas and the University Dakota Azure in France have been engaged in a program of measuring the position of the moon by shining high-powered laser beams at the moon and having them reflect directly back in these recorder reflectors and measuring the time difference between the pulse they sent out and the pulse they got back, which is about 1 second. The distance of the moon, since the time can be measured very accurately, the distance of the moon can be determined very accurately as well. It's an impressive experiment. About a billion photons are sent out 10 times a second, but the beam spreads over many kilometers, and returning photons have been detected only once every few seconds. But they've been detected for over 30 years, and as a consequence, we know the position of the moon very accurately to only a few centimeters over time. And from that, we can deduce the moon's orbit very accurately, and we can see that the Earth and the moon are both falling towards the sun with the same acceleration, a few parts in 1,000 billion. Now, this universality of free fall is something that's been known at least since the time of Galileo Newton. It's an old story in some ways. And Newton, in fact, provided some of the most accurate experiments for his time, but did not provide an explanation of why things that are made of different stuff, different material, all fall in gravity with the same acceleration. Newton provided one kind of explanation. Newton's first law of mechanics tells you that if you have a body, it moves on a straight line at a constant speed unless it's acted upon by some force. So if I toss a ball into the air, it goes up and it comes down, according to Newton, not moving in a straight line, of course, because the force of gravity is pulling it down. So according to Newton, the fact that things fall with all the same acceleration is just a lucky accident, right, of the particular nature of the gravitational force that's causing things to deviate from straight line motion. Albert Einstein, right, in his General Theory of Relativity in 1915, provided a deeper explanation, one that has many ramifications. According to Einstein, the Earth exerts no force at all on the ball. It's moving freely. But it's moving freely, in fact, on the straightest possible curve it can, but in a curved space-time that's produced by the Earth. The Earth very slightly curves the space-time outside of it. The ball tries to move on the straightest possible path, and that straightest possible path is the parabola that connects the two instants between when I released the ball and when I caught it. Now, this may seem like a complicated way to explain a parabola, but it has one important consequence. It explains the universality of free fall. So here's a little picture of space-time, height this way and time up that way. That's what we mean by space-time. Here's the parabola going to greater height is with increasing time and then back down again. So there's the path it executes. This may not look like a straight line to you, but that's because this is like a map, just like, for example, going from someplace in Europe to Toronto, the straight line path is a great circle on the surface of the Earth. And when you draw it, it doesn't look straight, but it is straight if you go think about the geometry of the Earth. So Einstein explained the universality of free fall by the simple fact that there is no force acting on the body, therefore all bodies are moving freely. There's only one curve, a straight line curve in the curved space-time of the Earth, and therefore all bodies move along it with the same acceleration. So Einstein thereby provided an explanation of the universality of free fall, and this little simple thought experiment is the basic underlying origin of general relativity. The fact that space-time is curved means, and it's space-time that's curved, not just space, right, means that, to put it loosely, time runs at different rates at different points in space-time. That's having different times for different states of motion was a already something that was, we have the date wrong on this, not 1905, special theory of relativity, is the idea that Einstein had that moving clocks run slow. If you have a clock that is moving with velocity v above the Earth, for example, and it sends out signals once every second, then an identical clock on the surface of the Earth will receive those signals at more than 1 second intervals, depending on how fast it's moving, and therefore this clock thinks that one is running slow. It's not a very big effect, right? It's the origin of the famous twin paradox. If you stay at home and your spouse takes a trip to the center of the galaxy and back, your spouse will have aged less when they return, right, than you will have. The reason is because they're moving and their clocks, including the clocks that govern aging, are running slowly compared to your clock. The effect also works if your spouse goes to the grocery store, right? But the effect is much smaller, and I don't think it makes up for the aggravation and the increased aging actually going to the store. The effect is very small. If you spent your entire life traveling on an airplane, 500 miles an hour, your life would be longer by 5/10,000ths of a second, according to me. Well, that seems like a small effect, but just one moment. But gravity, right, this previous effect had nothing to do with gravity, gravity introduces a qualitatively new effect, which is that clocks higher up in a gravitational field run fast, the opposite effect. So if you have two clocks which are at relative rest and on the surface of the Earth and one is higher up than the other, then signals emitted at 1 second interval by this clock will be received by this clock at shorter intervals. So this clock will be seen to be running fast. So high-class theorists that would like their offices on the top of the building are making a small mistake because their lives will be just a little shorter, other things being equal. It's not much. It's a few microseconds, I calculate, in a lifetime at five stories at the top of the Perimeter Institute, and maybe that's worth a view. Well, these sounds like small and trivial effects in the theory, but many of you will have already used them every day, and that's because they're important in the functioning of the global positioning system. Let me just recall a few facts about the global positioning system. It's a network of 24 or more satellites, which are in 12-hour orbits around the Earth. And these satellites send out signals periodically. And the signals contain information about what time it is and where the satellite is located, which can be determined by ground-based telemetry. So here's a satellite. If it sends out a signal telling what time it sent the signal out, if you then receive that signal and you know the time at which you got it, then you know you're a distance away from the satellite, which is the time difference divided by the speed of light. In other words, you know you're on some sphere like this. If you've got two satellites, then you know you're on the intersection of two spheres. If you've got more satellites, the ambiguity gets reduced. And in fact, if you've got four or more satellites, you don't even have to know what time it is, because you can figure out the time from, and that's actually the way the GPS system works. But relativistic effects are important in the global positioning system. Both of the ones I mentioned are important because, first of all, the satellites are moving with respect to the Earth, so the clocks that they carry, right, will be seen as moving slow on the ground. The net difference is about 0.8 times 10 to the minus 10 as a fractional error. Right, but they're also higher up, so their clocks will be seen as running fast, right, compared to the clocks on the surface of the Earth by this amount. That's very small, but the difference doesn't exactly cancel, and since it takes light in a nanosecond, light travels 1/3 of a meter, right? So if you're aimed at 2 meter accuracies, you have to have extraordinarily accurate clocks, and you have to correct for this effect. And what happens is that the clocks on the satellites are offset by the combination of these two effects. If that didn't happen, right, if the satellites didn't take into account Einstein's special relativity and also his general relativity, it would fail in about a half an hour, the whole system. It's an interesting anecdote that the first Navistar satellite that was put up, the engineers that designed it thought relativity was a sort of suspicious, flaky subject, right? And they built the Navistar satellite with like a dial, so they could dial relativity in or out, and depending on what happened. But of course, they checked, and for approximately a month or so, the Navistar satellites were actually giving a test of these effects of relativity, because the engineers could see the offsets. Then it's no longer a test, it's in the electronics, and you use it every day. So, who says general relativity is not a practical subject? Now, those are very small fields in the solar system. It's difficult to believe today, but at the time of Einstein's death in 1955, his general theory of relativity was regarded as something of a failure. In the introduction to Einstein's Festschrift in 49, Millikan doesn't even mention the general theory. And Oppenheimer, in 1956, in his obituary, would say, in the 40 years that have elapsed between the discovery of relativity and now, with one principal exception, the only connection between the four famous experimental tests of relativity were the only connections with experience. How different this picture looks today. As Oppenheimer mentioned, general relativity is certainly important in cosmology, right? General relativity predicts unequivocally that the universe is expanding, that it had a history, and furthermore, as was shown by Penrose and Hawking, that history started with the Big Bang. And I'm going to be showing a few of these pictures, so I'll take a moment to sort of space and time are a four-dimensional continuum, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. But I can't draw four dimensions on the surface of a paper. So the compromise is to try and draw two of those dimensions, one time dimension, which is what we've got, and one space dimension. So what I'm trying to do is draw a picture of the space-time here, which is like a little surface, and I'm drawing it in perspective. In this particular case, this easy visualization, I've drawn a closed universe here, which is expanded, that is, it was smaller way back here, and as time moves on, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So here's the Big Bang, it gets bigger, and 13.7 billion years later, it's as big as it is now. So time is pointing upward in these pictures, and space is pointing horizontal. I also attempted to draw in the cosmic microwave background radiation I'll talk a little bit about later, which starts about 400,000 years after the Big Bang and can be seen today. It's light from the Big Bang. The key thing is that general relativity predicts that the starting point was what technically is called a singularity, a place of infinite density and infinite curvature and a breakdown, really, of the laws of classical physics. But today, general relativity is central not only for cosmology, as it was in Einstein's time, but for many other important frontier astrophysical phenomena. For pulsars, which are rotated structured pulsars, which are rotating neutron stars with a beam on them by which the sweeps by us, which we can see them pulse, and which are the source, for example, the energy in this little picture of the Crab Nova supernova explosion. Black holes are the Best Buy model for powering quasars and giant radio sources in the universe. This object here, this is a little picture of the Andromeda galaxy, if you can see, and this is the radio source Cygnus A, which is much larger than any galaxy, and right in the center, of course it's not possible to see, is a black hole about the size of the solar system, whose rotation is an important source of power, all that power that you see being dissipated in the radiation. It's behind galactic X-ray sources, which are, say, neutron stars or black holes in the center of near another star, which is pouring matter onto them. And as that matter pours on, it gradually falls in and heats up. It's behind the cosmic background radiation, which I'll see more later. It's certainly central for gravitational waves, which in fact are propagating ripples in the structure of space-time, which we hope to see from experiments now underway. It's too dark for you to see this one, I think, which is LISA, but that's all right because it's in the future. And it's important for the synthesis of elements in the Big Bang, hydrogen, helium, and lithium, beryllium, and boron, the light elements. General relativity is also central for one of the other great issues of the Perimeter Institute, which is the physics of the very small. Without general relativity, we would have never had considered extra dimensions, string theory, or quantum gravity. But my purpose here today is not to talk to you about the successes of general relativity. I rather want to talk to you about the sort of vision of physics that came out, right, from its successes. If you will, I mean, the thing which we learned from this success of general relativity, that the idea that by pure thought, you could abstract the fundamental laws from simple circumstances and principles, as Einstein did general relativity from the principle of equivalence, or the equality of gravitational inertia, the universality of free fall. There's the idea that nature favors theories with equations that are beautiful and simple when written in the mathematics itself, abstracted from the natural world. And there's an implicit injunction, which I think you can see throughout Einstein's career, the physicists to be courageous, to explore crazy ideas like curved space-time, and extra dimensions, and carry out the search for beauty, simplification, and unification in realms that are far from immediate experiment. This vision and the search for fundamental laws has had an enormous impact on contemporary physics, and many follow Einstein's guide today, and nowhere is that vision more clearly adhered to with more conviction than right here at the Perimeter Institute. But while Einstein's discussion of general relativity was very successful, there was another part of the story, his story, which was not so successful. And this was his conviction that there was a single unitary physical reality independent of human cognition and decision. That's, of course, the everyday notion of reality. We agree on the number of persons in this room, on the type of chairs that are here, what the speakers say, and so forth, one to the other. Those of us that don't agree are said to be delusional and out of touch with reality. Yet, even while his great achievement of general relativity was being developed and tested, the second great development of 20th century physics was emerging, quantum theory, and this was to undermine the unitary view of reality that was held by Einstein and others and is held by so many today. The history of quantum theory is very different from general relativity. Quantum theory was not the work of one person. It emerged rather in bits and pieces from the effort of a great many, Bohr, Heisenberg, Schrodinger, and Dirac, just to cite the transcendent geniuses that are associated with this subject. And it did not result from a graceful leap from a simple principle like the universality of free fall, as I described. Rather, has the impression from looking at the history that physicists were forced back into quantum mechanics, or maybe not back, forced into quantum mechanics by the experiments on the spectral properties of atoms and other atomic properties. Many went with reservations, puzzlement, and kicking and screaming. Some, even though they may not be exactly screaming today, are certainly still kicking, and I think I'm sandwiched today between, if you've had the privilege to hear Tony Leggett before me, and I can think I can conjecture with confidence Roger Penrose afterwards, you'll see two people that are still kicking. Now, why should people be kicking? Our most famous colleagues. Certainly it's not the success of quantum theory. Quantum theory is probably one of the most, would arguably be the most successful theory in the history of physics. It explains why the stars shine, how chemical bonds work that make up matter and life, why transistors work, why the BlackBerry works, why H-bombs work, superconductivity, why atoms are stable, and why your atoms don't interpenetrate your chair's atoms, precipitating you onto the floor, and many, many other things. It's not today, right? Some 80 years later, there is not one shred of experimental evidence against the theory. And all candidates for fundamental laws of physics, of the kind I described, applying in a microscopic domain, are framed in the framework of quantum mechanics. Even the proposed quantum theory of gravity, such as string theory or quantum geometry, is based on quantum theory. So what's to worry about? The answer, I believe, that quantum theory proposes a radically different view of the nature of reality from the familiar everyday experience, and there are many others, many people that are just unwilling to make that step. So let me try to explain how that, what I mean by that. Classical laws are deterministic. Quantum laws are probabilistic. What I mean by that is if I toss this tennis ball up in the air with a given position, it's not a tennis ball, this ball up in the air with a given position and velocity, and if I were able to reproduce that every time, according to classical physics, it would follow exactly the same curve. That's deterministic. The trajectory is determined by the initial condition. So Newtonian mechanics predicts one trajectory. According to quantum mechanics, however, it's not deterministic. The determinism is just an illusion. The ball could take any path from my hand. It could go a little bit off, a millimeter, or it could take even some dramatic non-classical path. For example, go through the floor to the region below and come back out. That's what's called classically forbidden, because you can't have any classical paths that do that, no matter what their initial conditions are. It's only, according to quantum mechanics, a matter of probability, what they are. And the probabilities are very small. I tried to calculate, for example, the probability that if I threw this little soccer ball, that and it landed at some point on the floor, it would come out 1 millimeter, right, from where Newton predicted it. And I got, there's only one chance in a number of zeros, a number with a number of zeros. Well, here's the number of zeros you'd have to write down. That chance is so small that if you just took 1 second to write every zero, the age of the universe would not be long enough just to write the odds down. So truly, right, in classical physics, it doesn't happen. But there are probabilities which become important in the microscopic world. Another perspective on this can be got from the uncertainty principle, which is part of quantum mechanics, which says you can't specify simultaneously both the initial velocity of a particle and the initial position of the particle. That is, even if you wanted to solve Newton's equations of motion, you couldn't do it because you couldn't find out what the initial conditions are. The uncertainty in the position multiplied by the uncertainty in the velocity has to be bigger than a number that's called Planck's constant divided by the mass. So you can, for example, find exactly what the velocity is, but then you lose all information about the position because it has to be so big that if this is very small, it multiplies to get this number. Conversely, you can, if you know the, I forget now which way I said it, if you know the position, then the velocity is uncertain. So even, for example, in a situation with high symmetry, where classically, for example, suppose you have a particle running around in the bottom of a bowl, classically the lowest energy state is the particle at rest, right, at the bottom. You can't have that in quantum mechanics, because that's specifying both position at the bottom and the velocity at rest. So what happens is, the lowest energy state, the particle still moves. It exhibits small quantum fluctuations in various directions, well, all possible directions around here, even at the bottom of the bowl, such that the result is consistent. These fluctuations are consistent with the uncertainty principle. For something like this, it's only, the fluctuations are only about the size of a proton, so it's not very important. But for an electron or something different, it could be important. And as I'll try and argue in a minute, those little fluctuations, right, are important for the structure of the universe that we see today. classical physics, the state of a system, meaning the complete description of it, right, means specifying, as I've already mentioned, both the position and the velocity of every particle at one instant, and from that you can use Newton's laws to determine whether they are at all the rest of the times. Now, you can't have that, as I've already just said, in quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, the state of the system is specified by an object called the wave function. It's written in psi. I'm not going to try and tell you what the wave function is, or even what it's a function of, right? But you can just remember that the state of a system is described by a certain function called the wave function. If you have two different states represented by two different wave functions, then you can add them and you get another state, right? And that leads to the phenomenon of quantum interference. Let me illustrate that with a very simple thought experiment, the famous two-slit experiment. Here's the two-slit experiment. You have a source of electrons over here, an electron gun, and the electrons move towards a screen where they can either go on this blue trajectory through the upper slit, another trajectory for the lower slit, and then are detected on the further screen. So that's an example of a superposition. On the other side of the screen, though, wave function, right, is a sum of a wave function where the electron is localized up here at the upper slit, plus a wave function where the electron is localized in the lower slit. It's a superposition. These examples occur, of course, in all elementary quantum mechanics books, but nowadays you can actually do the experiment. And here's the result with electrons by Tonomura et al. If you watch the screen, what you see is you can send in many electrons. Then you see little points of light scattered around randomly, and then more and more of them, an increasing number. But gradually, when the number gets big enough, and this is actual data, right, you see that there are regions where there are more electrons and less. So there's a sort of wave-like pattern here. That's called an interference pattern, where I've tried to draw the intensity up here on the other side of them. That's clear evidence for the wave nature of the electron. You see it right here in this wave. Now, you might think it's a reasonable question to ask, were there any one of the given electrons in here went through the upper slit or went through the lower slit? But quantum mechanics prohibits that question. You can't, it's not that it's not known, or it's ignorant, you're not allowed to ask it. And there's a definite part of the formalism which explains like this. So if you do an experiment like this, you can just check on whether the electron is in a superposition by finding out this wave or not. Of course, there's something else you can do, which is just go measure which slit the electron is through. If you measure which slit the electron went through, then you do determine which slit. It went through the upper slit, let's say. If you measured, you got a positive result from putting some detector here. But then you lose the interference pattern. So in this case, you can say the electron behaved like a particle and went through one of the other slits. You can't say it behaved like a wave. In this case, you can say it behaved like a wave, but you can't say whether it went through the upper slit or the lower slit. You can say either view, but not both. In the language of the theory, they're said to be complementary views. And this, in a nutshell, is why the notion of reality is different in quantum theory. Because there's not a single unique reality out there. It depends on which view you take. And both views are equally necessary because you might have done one experiment or the other. Erwin Schrödinger, who was one of the founders of quantum mechanics, put this in a nice experiment with his famous cat. Here's a picture of Schrödinger's cat. I'll just read from Schrödinger here. He says, one can set up even quite ridiculous cases. A cat is penned up in a steel chamber along with the following diabolical device, which must be secured against direct interference by the cat, showing Schrödinger had some appreciation of cats. In a Geiger count is a tiny bit of radioactive substance, so small that perhaps in the course of 1 hour, one of the atoms decays, but also with equal probability, perhaps none. If it happens to counter two discharges through a relay, releases a hammer, right, which is shatters a small flask of hydrocyanic acid. If one has left the entire system to itself for an hour, one would say that the cat still lives if, meanwhile, no atom has decayed, but the first atomic decay would have poisoned it. The psi function, the wave function, the entire system would express this by having the cat in it, having the dead cat, pardon the expression, mixed or smeared out in equal parts, i.e., in a superposition. So this experiment is not qualitatively different from the one I did before. It's only that it has to do with cats. So the state of the cat is in a superposition where you might have had no decay, no click, right, and the cat's alive in the box, or it might have decayed, the acid been released, the cat was dead. So now comes the question, at the end of the hour, is the cat alive or dead? Well, or is it rather in a superposition of the kind described? Well, you could check. You could do the experiment. If you open the box and look, then half of the time, if you do a lot of experiments, the cat will be alive, and half of the time, it will be dead. But there's a 100% chance you'll find it either alive or dead. Now, you might think this is looking bad for the principle for superpositions. But according to the theory, there's another experiment you can do, which is to check on whether the wave function is in superposition or not. In fact, I mean, if we could send this whole apparatus through a gigantic two-slit experiment, it would just be another interference experiment you could do. Therefore, you can't say in quantum mechanics the cat is either alive or dead. That's one view, but a completely another view is that the cat is in the superposition or not in the superposition. And depending on which experiment you do, you'll get a different result. Now, no one has done interference with objects like cats yet, because it's quite hard, but experimenters are getting close. We can now, a group of Zeilinger in Vienna has successfully interfered biomolecules. This is tetraphenylporphyrin, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And it's not some little electron, it's quite a large molecule. And it even sort of looks like a cat if you look at it in the right, way. It's not exactly the two-slit experiment, right, because it uses a different type of interferometer, but it's the same idea with the principle. So you send the, it goes through two different gradients, which are shifted. Right, and you get a superposition, and here are the interference fringes for this molecule, right, down here in terms of number of counts versus position of the interference of the third grating in this apparatus in measured in micrometers. They also hold world records for the biggest thing, the fluorofullerene C60 F48, right, has also been successfully interfered. So we're not quite at a cat. But quantum mechanics is looking pretty good with larger and larger systems, which are certainly of biological relevance. So where does this leave us, right? I'm used to the idea that we have partial information. And suppose it's really difficult to describe to you the exact situation. I'm going to try a little analogy here, which is not perfect. So. And being recorded, I suppose, is a potentiality of being sued by my colleagues later, but at least it carries the flavor, right, of what's going on. Let's suppose you had a lot of pictures of partial information. You had a lot of pictures of individual pictures of parts of cats, like this. Of course, I'm incompetent. Then you expect that if you studied all these views, different views, carefully, you'd be able to assemble them in one complete picture, if you had enough of them. And you'd get a picture of a cat. And that's what happens classically. Because there's only one thing out there independent of human cognition, the cat. You have partial information, so it's guaranteed that those pictures, if accurately taken, will fit together. But what if the views, would you say, if the views could never be fit together? So you can have the views. There, you could examine them in detail. They're each valid. They were got in different experiments. But there was no one single picture to which these were all partial views. That's what quantum mechanics is like. Quantum reality consists of many complementary views, mutually exclusive, because you can't check on any two at once, but equally necessary because you might check on any one. And that's why people are kicking. Now, I've been considering the a little sort of model universe, first of an electron and then of a cat. But what if we consider the real universe, the whole thing, the universe that we're in? Now, I mentioned experiments in quantum theory haven't gotten very far towards, well, they're improving, they haven't gotten very far towards getting anything as large as the universe. And we have no evidence that quantum mechanics holds on such large scales. Although every single fundamental theory that we expect to hold is formulated in quantum mechanics, mechanical terms. And therefore, following Einstein's implicit implicit injunction to be courageous and push things to the extreme, it's an interesting theoretical question to apply quantum mechanics to the universe as a whole. That would be a quantum mechanics of cosmology. Einstein's part of Einstein's general theory of relativity. In particular, we would then have to have a wave function of the universe, the entire system, which is denoted by an even larger psi with serifs, usually, to sort of show that it's the really big, big wave function. And there would be a quantum mechanical description of everything that goes on in the universe, even things, for example, in this room. It would be an interesting intellectual exercise to try and sort of describe what's going on in this room from the point of view of a wave function of the universe, but it would be unlikely to yield practical tests. The real motivation for doing this, taking this idea seriously, lies in the Big Bang. In the Big Bang, the largest possible system, the whole universe, is as small as it possibly can be. So in the Big Bang, large and small are one, and we can expect quantum phenomena will inevitably be important there, in particular fluctuations in the geometry of space-time. And such a wave function of the universe would constitute a theory of the universe's initial condition, and such a theory is just as necessary as the dynamical laws, for example, string theory and other parts of quantum mechanics, for a complete description of nature. In other words, a theory of this wave function is another one of the fundamental laws of physics, the kind being pursued here at the Perimeter Institute. Well, that sounds like a tall order. How are we possibly going to guess the wave function of the universe? After all, the universe looks incredibly complex from my perspective, even here, lots of different people wearing different clothing. There's a lot of information to write down. The reason we're able to do that is because although the universe is very complex on small scales, right, the scales of this room, it's remarkably simple on large scales. And I'll just offer two pieces of evidence for that. The two pieces of evidence are, one of these is a picture, as close as I can come to a picture of the whole universe today. And the other is a picture of the universe 400,000 years after the Big Bang. The top picture is the 2DF galaxy survey. And what this is they took a slice of an angular slice of the universe. So we take like a little wedge going out from the observer has a certain angular thickness, and they counted galaxies in that wedge. I don't know, is it possible to maybe a little experimentation with the focus might be, oh, it's down here. I'm not going to try that. This picture consists of lots of points, and each point is a galaxy. So the galaxy is located by its direction from us, and by its redshift, which in cosmology is essentially the same as the distance. Of course, when you get out here, things start to thin out because you can't see all the galaxies. But if you look in here, in these near regions, you can see that the distribution of galaxies certainly shows some structure. It has these filaments and webs, voids, knots, and so forth. And if you were privileged to hear some of the other lectures, you'd know a lot more about that. But if you squint your eyes, on the very largest scale, right, it's more or less uniform, more or less same in one place as in any other, more or less same in one direction as in any other. So that's the day, approximately 14 billion years after the Big Bang, right? And 400,000 years after the Big Bang, we have the cosmic background radiation. the Big Bang was hot, and radiation, of course, because it was hot, it was radiating, and light from has been propagating to us from the hot Big Bang at the original temperature when the universe became transparent to electromagnetic radiation, about 3,000 degrees. The expansion of the universe has lowered, cooled the radiation, and now it's only 2.725 degrees above absolute zero. And this little map is which is from the WMAP satellite, is a map of the temperature fluctuations. Some part of the sky is cooler than others, and some part is hotter. Some part is just in between. So this map shows you regions of the sky which are hotter and cooler, therefore they represent the structure of the universe at a very early time. The only thing is that these maps are only the differences between the red and the blue here. It's only a few 10 millionths of a degree. So you could see this map on the scale of the resolution of your eyes, you wouldn't see anything. The universe is essentially featureless in the beginning, as far as we can tell. But those little features are important because the theory is that the little features grew from under the action of gravitational attraction. The more dense regions, the cooler regions grew from under gravitational attraction, become the inhomogeneities in the stars, the planets, and the galaxies that we see today in this picture. But the key point I want to stress here is that the universe on the largest scales is simple, and early on it was even simpler still. And that led people to propose the idea that maybe the observed simplicity of the early universe could be most easily explained if the universe started from the simplest of all and most symmetric of all possible cosmological states, its ground state. Now, the nature of the state is a little hard to spell out mathematically, but I'm going to follow the injunction of no equations and describe it to you just in pictures. So this is an idea that's due to Stephen Hawking and his collaborators, and it's called the no-boundary proposal for a reason which we'll see. So I'm going to describe it by just sort of drawing pictures of what the geometries, right, the cosmological geometries that are most important in this wave function of the universe. Now, I've already remarked that in general relativity, the Einstein's theory predicts that if you go far enough back in the universe, you get a Big Bang, an infinite curvature, infinite density, infinite tidal gravitational forces. The idea in the no-boundary proposal is there aren't any such geometries contributing. If you go far enough back in time, at 10 to the minus 43 seconds, you don't have any boundary. The universe just sort of closes off, and that's why it's called the no-boundary proposal, because there's no other boundary and no singularity in the universe. Only spacetimes that are regular and closed in the beginning are now. Now, I've already mentioned that the regular behavior of classical general relativity, the singularity of classical, that such regular behavior is not allowed in classical general relativity, because general relativity predicts a Big Bang. Right? So the smooth regular behavior in the beginning is classically forbidden. But this is quantum mechanics, and we know that things that are classically forbidden can actually occur. And that's the idea in the Big Boundary proposal. One simple way to see that it's forbidden is to consider the idea of time. I mentioned in these diagrams I was going to be drawing time up and space up. So at each point here, there's a time direction and a space direction. But if the geometry is sort of regular down at the bottom, what happens if down here at the South Pole? Right? Which direction is going to be time and which is going to be space? Well, the universe solves this problem by having not three space dimensions and one time dimension, but four space dimensions down here. So this is classically forbidden. It's not classically forbidden. There's no notion of time here. This is a quantum mechanical regime. And in a sense, the universe tunnels in the same way as we had that little picture of the ball tunneling through the ground, out from an initial Euclidean, space-space condition to a condition of space-time of the kind we're allowed. The fact that the notion of time breaks down is important for explaining other things. For example, the question of what came before the Big Bang. Sufficiently early, there isn't any notion of before. Now, the no-boundary proposal doesn't predict a single unique space-time for the subsequent evolution of the universe, like our picture here. This is a quantum mechanical initial condition. It predicts probabilities for various geometries that are of this sort. On the average, like the pictures I've drawn here, these are homogeneous, isotropic. They're the same in one direction as any other, the same in one point as in any other. And that explains why the universe has these properties on the various large scales. But a quantum mechanical proposal like this doesn't predict exact smoothness. Any more, for example, than our example about the particle at the bottom of the bowl, which is classically as symmetric as possible, but is exactly exhibiting little quantum fluctuations. Similarly, the universe exhibits little quantum fluctuations, little irregularities, defects in the exact symmetries of the universe. The same quantum principles of the uncertainty principle applied to the no-boundary wave function shows that for the universe, it predicts homogeneity, symmetry on the average, but fluctuations in particular. In particular, it predicts the quantum fluctuations that show up later that are observed by the WMAP satellite at 400,000 years after the Big Bang and are observed by us today as stars, galaxies, and the large-scale structure of the universe. So this is a good candidate for the origin of the universe. But it does have an interesting relation to the question of Einstein's notion of reality, because you can ask, if you look at that WMAG picture, which I had a little while ago and won't try to retrieve, does it predict exactly that picture? The answer is no. It doesn't. It only predicts various possible pictures. It predicts overall symmetry, but the detailed fluctuations, many different detailed fluctuations, are predicted with various probabilities. So the universe, in fact, is in a superposition of states in which you might have had one of those patterns for WMAP, another pattern for WMAP, and so forth. Not one, but it's in a superposition. But after all, I've just argued that those little fluctuations are the origin of all the inhomogeneities, the fluctuation of all the irregularities in the universe we see today. That includes the galaxies, the stars, the planets, the Earth, the trees, the human beings, you in particular. So I have some possible bad news for you, ladies and gentlemen. We're all Schrodinger cats in each one of us in Hawking's wave function of the universe. How do you feel? A little fuzzier? Well, no. The predictions are completely consistent with what we see. But it does mean pushed to its extreme, that quantum reality, just as in the two-slit experiment and the Schrodinger cat experiment and Hawking's wave function of the universe, I had two versions of this transparency, and I couldn't quite decide which one to put out. So here's the first one. Quantum reality consists of many mutually exclusive but equally necessary complementary views. Whether it's for the electron, the cat, and the wave function of the universe. And here's the other transparency. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. So I believe we have some time for some questions. So just, if you could, there's a problem with bringing the mic around. So if you could just stand up and speak loudly so we can all hear you when you have a question. Yes, the gentleman in the back.
You made a passing reference, I think, to possible experimental results around theories of gravity. I think it would be useful if you could briefly give us some indication of what some of the leading experiments are likely to put like. What results we might see in the coming 5 or 10 or 15 year time frame that would point the way forward in some of the contending theories. I know it's a big talk, but
It is indeed, right, and I deliberately only showed you, well, not even one experiment, really. The question was, could I comment on what future experiments in gravitational physics might we see in the coming years? I should stress first that we don't expect to see any experiments in quantum gravity, the wave function of the universe, if you like. That's from cosmological labs. But the classical theory of general relativity has a long history of experimentation. There are the famous classic tests, right, of the bending of light by the sun, the gravitational redshift, right, Shapiro time delay, right, and the precession of the perihelion of Mercury. All that's now checked to accuracies of about 0.5%. And indeed, the recent Cassini flyby, right, of Saturn tested the experiments. Detected one part of Einstein's theory to an accuracy of a few parts of 10 to the fifth. So Einstein is looking very good in the solar system. Right now flying, launched last April 10th, is the Gravity Probe B satellite that will test one other aspect of gravitational physics. There used to be the idea that gravity depends on the distribution of mass. But just like electromagnetism, where you can have electric fields that come from charge, if charge moves, it produces currents, and you get gravitomagnetic currents. Those are much weaker because they're a factor of the velocity divided by the speed of light less. But the GPB experiment hopes to see gravitomagnetic effects, right, from the rotation of the Earth. We'll see that in maybe 18 months or so. But by far the biggest experiments on the horizons, and the ones that have to do with strong gravity, are the gravitational wave detectors, which I alluded to. There's a worldwide network of detectors now under construction. The U.S. candidates are at Hanford, Washington, and Livingston, Louisiana. It's called LIGO, and there's big collaborations in France and Italy, the Virgo detectors, the GEO-600 detector in Germany, and a bunch of other ones. Those will see for the first time directly this famous prediction of Einstein's theory that they're gravitational. With their gravitational waves, propagating ripples in space-time curvature. Beyond that, we have to go to space, right, for gravity waves at very low frequency. And there's, in NASA's long-range plan, there's the so-called LISA experiment, which is a 5 million kilometer arm experiment in space, which was looking pretty good until the Go to Mars initiative sort of interfered with it. So, but those are just some of the things we can expect in the next decade. Other questions?
Yes.
How do you think that LISA would shed light on aspects of quantum gravity?
I'm sorry, but let me see if I got the question right. How do you think LISA will change LIGO? And
LISA
Oh, shed light on quantum gravity. We're still quite far from doing direct quantum gravitational tests. There's one possibility, right, which is that just like there's a microwave background in electromagnetic radiation coming from the Big Bang, there's also background in neutrinos, for example, coming from the Big Bang. If we could detect it, and there's also a gravitational wave background coming from the Big Bang. But I think it's fair to say us theorists don't know how to calculate that, make the prediction very accurately, because we don't understand the Big Bang though, right? But should Lisa see some broad background, then that might be shed some light on quantum gravity, but it's only a hope. Other questions? The question was, if I have a wave function of the universe, right, does it contain, for example, this lecture? And if it does, what does it have to say about free will? Let me answer the second question first. My colleague Gell-Mann used to ask me, he said, if you know the wave function of the universe, why aren't you rich? And the answer is, it does predict something about every single possibility in the universe. It predicts a probability. But most of those probabilities are unfortunately, for example, probabilities for the New York Stock Exchange going up tomorrow. They're predicted, in principle. We could write them down. But they're very likely to be 50-50. That is, contain no useful information. So only a few things, right, such as the galaxy-galaxy correlation function, some of these pictures which I showed you, do we expect will be predicted with useful probabilities. So you should have to draw the distinction between probabilities and useful probabilities. And there's a sense in which, a deeper sense in which it cannot predict everything. Because, as we've already described, and I think as you're implying, the present universe is complex. Now, I didn't write down the formula for the wave function of the universe, but let me assure you it only takes about 42 LaTeX keystrokes to enter. It's a very short formula, about that long. Now you say, well, that's just a fraud because nobody knows what those symbols mean. But it only takes, you know, 20 or 30 physics textbooks to explain what those symbols mean. It's that, right? So it's not a lot of information that's contained in it. And therefore, in fact, quantum mechanics is essential to providing a boundary condition of the universe because it's the only way that the present complexity could be incorporated probabilistically. You have a simple law, and then it's the result of quantum accidents that have happened over the course of the universe that determines whether you like vanilla ice cream or not, or some other detail, or the New York Stock Exchange for that matter. So, yes, it's contained. The probabilities are probably not useful for things. Whether it has that, whether quantum mechanics has anything to do with free will, that is a issue for psychologists. I think the prevailing view is that you know, in neural theory is that you don't have to, you could have fluctuations. They don't have to be quantum mechanical, especially to produce free will. I don't want to start on this particular subject. I could, right? Great point. Step into Schrodinger's box. I don't know what Schrodinger's box is, but I see. Your place. No, I wouldn't get in the box. It's 50-50 whether it goes off in the next hour. So if that's what you mean by believing the wave function of the universe, I think, so the question, we'd have to go into exactly what's meant by many worlds, right? And the way I don't like this terminology, right? So I would, on that grounds, I would say I'm probably not consistent with the many worlds people. But including the terminology inside, there's a great amount which is in common, which is taking quantum mechanics seriously for the largest possible physical system, which is the universe, which is exactly what they did. So I would prefer to say, you know, the quantum what the worlds they're referring to are different possible alternative histories of what might have happened. What you ordered for breakfast or didn't order for breakfast. Right? So quantum mechanics, those are different alternative histories, and those, I think, are the worlds that the people are talking about. So I would prefer to say that quantum mechanics is a probabilistic theory that predicts probabilities for many different things that can happen, and the different things are not distinguished except by probabilities. If that's the same as many worlds, then many worlds, if not, not.
Let's take maybe one more question.
Wait a minute, I think we have. I explained the whole universe and I don't get any more questions than this. Well, that's the point, I suppose, right? But back then, there wasn't an exact notion of time. There's an exact notion of time to 10 to the minus 43 seconds. But the basic notion of classic time is a classical notion, which breaks down, and the classical notion of time breaks down. There's a space-time, if you like, a geometry, which is four-dimensional. But it, in a certain particular sense, it doesn't have a time direction. So you can say, I mean, it's perfectly, if for ordinary, practical, everyday purposes, you can say that time began 13.7 billion years ago with the Big Bang. We're only talking about a little 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Important in this type of consideration, but not on that scale. Oh, thank you. No quantum gravity here. That, of course, is what they hope to do.
Yeah.
Down to 10 to the minus 4 hertz. I don't think so. I mean, if I had to guess, I mean, one doesn't know. It's an experiment. Right? We'll see what happens. Maybe we'll find some unusual phenomena that we can explain. The binary black holes, I mean, that's all just quite possible.
What type of situation?
Well, we'd have to look for the evaporation of black holes to see something quantum mechanical. And, you know, even a 10 to the 15 gram solar mass black hole affects the age of the universe in about a billion solar mass or a billion solar mass black hole takes many times the lifetime of the universe. We will never see that, no matter what conceivable factors.
It would be difficult then for these sets to detect aspects of black hole evaporation.